Another thing to consider is when you find a property that you would have bought except it has a contract on it already, you can always put a backup contract on the property. What this does is alerts the seller of the property that there is another interested party if the current purchaser can't get finance or wants extensions to the conditional period, then the seller may be less lenient and take up your offer. The final comment to be made is regarding the legal searches that would be completed by your solicitor. For example, the main road search and contaminated land search. Often people don't want to spend the money on these searches until they know the contract is unconditional, and they are definitely going ahead with the purchase. The problem with this strategy is that if anything unexpected is revealed in these searches, it may be too late for you to get out of the contract because you are now unconditional, and in reality, it may now cost you a lot more money. So instead, it is advisable that you have these searches done during the conditional phase of the contract. Go onto your State Real Estate Institute website and print out a copy of the standard contract and have a thorough read. If you have any questions about anything, ask your coach for help. Sale contract. In this section, the sale contracts will be looked at from the perspective of you being the seller, and so we want to ensure that the contract is prepared in your favour. This will not be gone into in as much detail as in the previous section when you were the purchaser, because in reality, your solicitor or real estate agent will be preparing the contract, and so you should have already checked that all the pre-completed details are correct. What we are focusing on here is reviewing the details that the purchaser will complete. Buyer's name. When the buyer is an entity like a company, trust, or self-managed super fund, you need to confirm that they have completed the entity name correctly and that the signatory is in fact authorised to sign. If these details are incorrect, this may leave the contract open and subject to being gotten out of, which of course is not what we want as the seller. We want the contract to be as watertight as possible. Deposit. When you are the seller, obviously you want to hold as large a deposit as possible so as to give the buyer more incentive to settle. If the amount is too low, then they do not have a lot to lose if they pull out of the contract. Remember, though, that the deposit is fully refundable if the buyer exits the contract during the conditional period based on one of their set conditions. Even if they pull out of the contract once unconditional, it is not uncommon for you to have to take them to court to be able to claim on the deposit. A way to get around this as the seller is to include a special condition in the contract that says that the deposit becomes non-refundable and is released to the seller once the contract goes unconditional. Maybe this is something you could consider adding to the contract if the buyer is negotiating with you on terms and you need something to be able to bargain with from your end. Special conditions. Another special condition that is of value from the seller's perspective is the sunset clause. A sunset clause states that in the event of another offer being received, the first buyer has a set period of time, say 72 hours, to go unconditional on the contract. Otherwise, their contract ceases and the new purchaser can enter into contract. This is a particularly useful clause for the seller to request if the buyer's offer is subject to fairly onerous conditions, like being subject to the sale of another property or subject to a lengthy due diligence period. It gives you, the seller, flexibility to continue to market the property or consider other offers even while still having a contract in place. Obviously, as the seller, you want to ensure that all of the other clauses and timeframes in the contract are as tight as possible. You want their timeframes short for inspections, finance and settlement, their deposit as large as possible, and their other conditions not too onerous, and as much as possible in your favour. Disclosure document. As a seller, there will be situations where you want to sell a property prior to having legal title. An example of this is selling off the plan and selling prior to construction, or selling prior to the titles department having issued title on the newly created property, whether it is a unit development or subdivision. In this instance, the sale contract needs to also include a disclosure document that sets out the details of the property. This document will be compiled by your solicitor, but will involve information from your surveyor and body corporate manager, to name a few, and it needs to be compiled earlier in the process than it would if you were going to contract after titles had been issued. As an example, the items included in a disclosed document for an off-the-plan sale of units or townhouses will include: first statement, details the standard terms of the sale, draft survey plan, diagram that shows the proposed survey boundaries, proposed annual budget and schedule of contributions, body corporate documents that detail the proposed annual budget and owner's contributions, body corporate manager administration agreement, document that outlines the conditions and fees of the body corporate manager, community management statement, document that outlines the management conditions and bylaws of the body corporate scheme, power of attorney documents, documents prepared by the solicitor, schedule of finishes, details the fittings and finishes of the end product being sold, for example, the unit, house or land. Disclosure statement. Contents. Part 1, first statement. Part 2, draft survey plan. Part 3, proposed annual budget and schedule of contributions. Part 4, body corporate manager administration agreement. Part 5, community management statement. Part 6, deed appointing attorney. Part 7, power of attorney disclosure. Property management contract. A property management contract is a document that you will complete when you are tenanting a property and engaging a property manager to handle the process for you. These are generally a standard document used in your state, and see the example below. They are fairly straightforward and self-explanatory, and so will not be gone into heading by heading. What is to be highlighted, though, are a couple of the less obvious aspects. The first is the duration of the contract. Typically, you will be entering into a continuing appointment, which means it continues indefinitely. The notice period given to terminate the agreement is particularly significant. Typically, this will state 60 days. However, I suggest amending this to more like 30 days, because let's face it, if you have an issue with a property manager, you want to get out sooner rather than later, and while 60 days is in their interest, it is not in yours. The other aspect is the assignment clause, which allows the agent to assign the management contract to another agent for whatever reason they choose. The obvious reason is if they sell their rent roll to another agent. Typically, this section is pre-filled out to say that you agree with the assignment clause. In contrast, it is preferable to tick that you disagree with this clause because you want to have the final say as to who is the manager of your properties. You want to maintain the control and have the choice to change managers if you so choose. Also remember that this contract is open to negotiation, including the management fee, the lease negotiation renewal fee, the maintenance repair fee, the periodic inspection fee, and the administrative expenses. Remember, though, that you do not want to negotiate too hard with the agent, or they may become less interested in your property. You do not want them to give you the less desirable tenants or recommend another property above yours because they will get a higher management fee from it. Remember the bigger picture and that you want the best relationship possible with your property manager to ensure you get the best service from them. Finally, if you are planning or inserting any special conditions into the management agreement, it is best that you have them correctly drafted, preferably by a solicitor. This is because if the condition you add contravenes the standard clauses in the contract, this can result in your condition being null and void, which obviously is not the intention. Also, in some states, even the property manager is not legally authorised to enter special conditions to the agreement. So again, clarify this for your state. Build contract. When undertaking either a major renovation or new construction project, and you are using a builder, it is essential that you have a build contract in place prior to works commencing. There is a difference between residential and commercial build contracts, and typically the latter is much less prescriptive and is more open to the specifics of the project, the builder, and the client. A residential build contract, in contrast, tends to be much more prescriptive, and the one we will cover in a bit more detail, as it's the one you are likely to be using for renovation and house construction projects. In fact, depending on your builder, you may stick with a residential build contract even up to, say, a 2 or 3 unit size project, just depending on the project cost and the financier. Certainly, the larger the contract and the greater your construction finance, the greater input the financier will have on the nature of the build contract used and the conditions included. Build contracts are generally a standard document where you fill in the blanks. There are a number of different types of contracts depending on the organisation that has prepared the standard document and also your state. Some contract examples include the Master Builders Association, Building and Construction Commission in your state, and Housing Industry Association, to name a few. There are examples below. Each contract will be written slightly differently and is likely to have a slight bias either more towards the builder or towards the client, depending on the organisation that has compiled the document. For example, the building contracts produced by the building associations are typically written to an extent in the builder's favour. For you, the client, this is not a reason to avoid using them. It's just something to be mindful of when you are reviewing the document and the conditions. You also need to consider the contract conditions from the worst case scenario and confirm that you are happy with what is being proposed. For example, what if the builder runs over time, or if the builder cannot access certain trades or materials to complete the work, or if there are wet weather delays or variations that result from you changing your mind or not clearly documenting your selections, preferences, from the outset? The list goes on. Do not assume that everything will be clear sailing, and then, when it is, because of your due diligence and preparedness, you will be pleasantly surprised. Certainly, preparation is the key with build contracts. You definitely cannot put in too much detail regarding your selections, fittings, fixtures, materials, colours, and even the position of those colours. Builders are not mind readers, and also they are on a tight time frame, and so if you have not specified something or its location is questionable, you run the risk of the builder making a decision on the fly, and if you do not agree with it, it may cost you money to have it rectified. So please spend the time upfront to document everything, whether that's on plan or in the specifications document. Just make sure it's in writing and that everyone agrees with it. Even if this process slightly delays the start of the build, that's okay, because it's much cheaper to change things on paper rather than once it has already been built. As with the previous contracts we spoke about, you need to understand and double-check every detail entered into a build contract, because it's surprising how even the property address, lot and plan number can be entered incorrectly. Another aspect to be very diligent about is understanding the insurance cover that will cover the build process. This will differ in each state. For example, in Queensland, it's the QBCC Homeowners Warranty Insurance, and in New South Wales, it's the Home Building Compensation Fund through Fair Trading New South Wales. What you need to understand is if the insurance covers you if the builder is at fault or goes bankrupt or just cannot complete the build for any reason. Also, does it cover the homeowner for the 6 to 7 year warranty that the builder must provide for structural issues post-completion? Where the guidelines can change, though, regarding insurance, is if you intend to be doing several build contracts with the same builder over the same time period, or if you are doing multi-units. In this situation, you need to double-check that the insurance covers you adequately, because in some states, as soon as you have multiple bills with the same builder, you may not be covered during the build process, and you may need to take out separate insurance for this purpose, including contract works and public liability insurance. A good insurance broker that deals with construction will assist you greatly with this also. Let's run through some of the main components that make up a standard build contract. Builder's details. Ensure that the builder's license is valid and will remain valid for the period of your build contract. Do a research on the state regulatory body that manages builder's licenses in your state to ensure that they are still registered, that they have no infringements or decisions against them, and no outstanding claims or a history of non-compliance or disputes. For example, in Queensland, all builders have to be licensed with the Queensland Building and Construction Commission, and in Victoria, it's the Victorian Building Authority. On their websites, you will be able to search by builder's name or license number, which will reveal their full license history. Clearly, if this search reveals anything unexpected, then more questions need to be asked, both of the builder and even the commission, to understand if the disputes are still active and to understand the information better. You also should do an ASIC company search on the building company and the directors to ensure that there are no issues. What you don't want to see is recent or regular changes in directorship and clearly no infringement issues. Some information will be free, but for a small cost you can access the company's full history, which is definitely recommended, recognising the amount of money you will be investing with them as your builder. Finance and lender. If you are needing to finance the construction project, you need to reflect this on the contract. If you do not know who the lender is at the stage of doing the build contract, you can specify to be advised, but definitely do not leave it blank, otherwise it generally defaults to not being subject to finance. The works. In this section, you describe the works that the contract covers. For example, you may describe the works as a new residential house, 4-bedroom, 2-bathroom, double lock-up garage, turnkey construction as per approved plans dated XYZ. Or it may say new residential turnkey construction of 3x3-bedroom townhouses, high set, lightweight construction as per approved plans and specifications dated XYZ. The more descriptive you can be, the better. Matters affecting site. This section is where you need to list any easements, building covenants or planning regulations that may affect the site. It is very important to disclose this so as to ensure it has been brought to the builder's attention, and therefore, if there is an issue, they cannot come back to you and say they were unaware of it. Build period, practical completion, inclement weather days, anticipated start date, and late completion damages. These are very important sections to complete and to understand the implications of. Firstly, the build period is the number of days the builder has allowed to complete the job. You need to understand if this time frame includes or excludes wet, inclement weather days, as this can make a huge difference. Obviously, you want the build period to be as short as possible, but it also needs to be balanced against the late completion damages amount. The amount is the penalty fee the builder incurs if they exceed the contracted build period. If this amount is too low, though, like the standard $50 a day that is often quoted, then clearly there is no incentive for the builder to actually complete it in the time frame specified. You want to ensure that the late completion damages amount is actually an amount that will give incentive to the builder to complete on time, like $100 a day. With the inclement weather days, this is the specified number of days allowed for in the contract for wet weather. More wet weather than this, though, and the builder can claim an extension on the completion date. What is important is to understand what defines wet weather or inclement weather. How much rain needs to occur? For example, does 1 hour of rain register as wet weather, or does it need to be more substantial? Different contracts will potentially have a different definition, and you need to understand it, because it can make the difference of your project blowing out or staying on budget. Other contract documents. In this section, you need to include all of the documents associated with the build contract. This includes the specifications documents, the full plan set, including engineering design, hydraulics plan, working drawings, any approvals, including building and development approvals, and operational works approval. It is a good idea to include the full name of the document, the number of pages, and the date it was finalised. This is because there are numerous versions of documents, and you want to ensure the builder is basing the construction on the most recent final version. Progress payment schedule. For residential contracts, there is a standard payment schedule based on percent amounts at each of the major construction milestones, being deposit, base, frame, enclosed, fixing, and practical completion stage. There is an example below. It is advisable to stick with the standard payment schedule, and certainly this is what the banks are most likely to want to see too. Prime cost and provisional sum items. Prime cost items are specified fittings and fixtures in the build price for which a fixed dollar amount has been allowed, for example, $40 per square metre for porcelain tiles. Classic examples include tiles, carpet, appliances, bathroom fittings, light fittings, where you may not yet have selected the actual item, and so the builder has specified you a budget to work with. If your final selection is higher or lower than the prime cost specified in this section, then this will be a variation to the contract, either a variation increase or variation decrease. Prime cost items should not be in a contract, as all your selections should have been made before getting to this contract stage, so as to ensure there are minimal variations in the contract, as these can cost you dearly. Certainly, you should be aiming to have zero variations during the build, and a way of achieving this is to have no prime cost items in your contract. Provisional sum items are similar to prime cost. However, they usually include a level of labour involved, but again, they are an allowance amount being included by the builder in the build contract to cover those items, for example, excavation, rock removal, concrete footings, etc. As above, including these items just leaves an opportunity for variations during the build, so try to keep these at an absolute minimum. Excluded items. Excluded items are those that are definitely excluded from the build contract, for example, landscaping, if you intend to do the landscaping yourself. Also, if you intend to supply certain materials yourself, that should be noted here. Be mindful, though, that anything you do or that you supply will not be covered by the builder's insurance and warranty. And while this may sound all right on the surface, it could have significant consequences down the track. For example, if you do the landscaping and mulch the gardens against the exterior wall of the building, this may promote termites, and the extra moisture from watering the plants may cause uneven wetting and drying of the soil, which can put different pressure on the footings that could potentially have an impact later on. Maybe the landscaping ground levels will not be perfect and runoff water may fall towards the building. And again, this could be detrimental. So you can see that even the simple act of doing the landscaping on a new build could have potential consequences if not done absolutely correctly. Special conditions. This section is where any special conditions to the contract are entered. Again, try to keep these to a minimum to reduce the potential for issues. If space does not permit in the other documents sections of the contract discussed earlier, include the full list of plans and specifications here. Signature page. Clearly, this is where all parties sign the contract. Ensure that you are signing on behalf of the entity that owns the land and that is commissioning the builder. So if this is a company trust structure, then confirm with your solicitor how this needs to be written on the contract and how it is signed for. Option contract. An option contract is a legal instrument used to secure a property and have control of the property without actually purchasing the property. An option comes in three forms: a call option, a put and call option. A call option is the buyer's option. It gives the buyer the right to purchase, but not the obligation to have to purchase a property. A put option is a seller's option. It gives the seller the right to sell the property to the buyer, but not the obligation to have to sell it. This is sometimes used in off-the-plan purchases. A put and call option is basically an unconditional agreement where the buyer must buy and the seller must sell at the agreed time, at the agreed price. Option contracts are a great tool and something you should ensure you understand and look to utilise wherever possible. They are particularly great for deals where having time on your side is beneficial and where the outcome of your research is still somewhat uncertain. A classic example is with development sites, where council approvals are required because these take time and also the outcome can be somewhat uncertain, particularly if you are pushing the council requirements. So depending on the application, you may choose to not proceed with the deal when the council decision is unfavourable. Because you have not had to actually settle on the property, your outlay will be much less during the option period, which is another benefit of an option agreement. The other significant benefit is that you can pass on the deal during the option period and therefore make a potential profit from the deal without even actually ever owning it. This will be explained in a bit more detail below as the main components of an option contract are outlined. This is definitely not going to be an exhaustive explanation of options, but will give you enough information to be informed when you speak with your solicitor about it in more detail. It is essential that any option contract is purpose written by a solicitor. It is definitely not a standard agreement that you can buy off the internet or use a template from someone else's deal. There is significant money at stake and you need to ensure that your own requirements and that of the seller are adequately covered. The last point to make before getting into the detail is that the dates in an option contract are critical. They must be adhered to the letter. If, for example, it says a document must be received by 5 p.m. on a given date, then it's not good enough that it is in the postal system at that time or that it is faxed or emailed through 1 hour later, because that in itself can result in non-compliance with the contract and the contract may be able to be terminated on you. There was one student that caught a plane from Brisbane to Canberra to hand deliver a document because that was the only way it was going to be received in the necessary time frame. So please do not be complacent with dates and time frames in contracts, in fact in any contract, as they are legal documents and with property, there is significant money at stake. General terms of the option contract. An option contract is actually made up of two documents. The first is the option contract that details the general terms of the option and includes the standard forms that will be outlined in more detail below. The second part is a standard contract of sale document that is relevant in your state for any standard sale of property, and again, this will be touched on below. Regarding the general terms of the option contract, though, this will cover off on the property details, the seller's details, the buyer's details, otherwise termed the grantee, the option time frame, and the agreed price. The option time frame is particularly important because often with students' option deals, they just haven't given themselves enough time. It is beneficial if the option time frame is as long as possible because you can always exercise the option sooner, but you can't just easily extend the period. An extension request requires you to renegotiate with the seller, and they have no obligation to grant it. So it can leave you somewhat vulnerable and may in fact cost you in cold hard cash if the seller negotiates in that way. Also, the longer the agreement is, the more time it gives you to get council approvals and to on-sell the option, which is essentially the property if you so choose. A great target time frame is 18 months to 2 years, although it does come down to what the seller will agree to, and therefore your skill as a negotiator. Certainly, a 1 or 2 month option contract is considered very short, although it must be acknowledged that it really does come down to your strategy and your intention with the property. Exercise of option. A unique part of an option contract is that you actually have to exercise the option and formally notify the seller that you are going to proceed with the option. Remember, this is because with a call option, you have the right to proceed but not the obligation. So you actually have to formally notify the seller that you want to proceed. To facilitate this, there will be a form at the back of the option contract that is the exercise of option form, and that needs to be completed and submitted to the seller or their solicitor within the required time frame. The process for exercising the option will be detailed in the general conditions of the option contract, and you need to follow these exactly. By agreeing to exercise the option, you are essentially entering into an unconditional purchase contract on the property, and that is where the sale contract document comes into play, which is outlined in more detail below. Nominee clause. Another important and unique part of an option contract is the nominee clause. This clause allows you to pass on the option contract to another party and, in effect, passing on this purchase of the property to them. An example of this might be where you put the property under option and during the option period you do something to improve its value, like getting council approval to develop the site. If you then want to on-sell the now development-approved site to someone else, you have the right to do so in the option contract by using the nominee clause and nominating the new buyer as the option holder. You would have a separate agreement with the new buyer at your agreed price, which is where you make your profit, and the new buyer would then have the right to exercise the option agreement and settle on the purchase at the nominated price in the option contract. There is a nomination notice included in the option contract, and this needs to be submitted in the manner and time frame detailed in the nominee clause of the option contract. And again, following this word for word is essential. Purchase price, premium, and deposit. The purchase price of the property is self-explanatory and is the total amount you have agreed to pay to purchase the property as detailed in the general terms of the option contract. Because the seller is granting you control of the property, but with the option still to not have to proceed with the purchase, and sometimes this is for an extended period of time, it is not uncommon that you will have to pay what's called a premium or an option fee. This is typically an amount of money that is non-refundable and is paid to the seller on countersigning of the option agreement. The money is released to them to do whatever they choose with it. From your perspective as the buyer, you want this amount to be as low as possible because it has to come out of your cash reserves. If you can negotiate it to, at say, $1,000, you are doing well. Even though people will say you should only pay $1, in reality, the seller's solicitor is likely to recommend to them that $1 is not enough. So again, it comes down to your negotiating skill that will determine what this amount is. It must be commercially viable for the seller to give you time to settle on the property and complete any applications you need to do on the property. The deposit amount is the amount agreed on and documented in the sale contract part of the agreement. This is the standard deposit that you would include in a normal sale contract. In this instance, though, it is not uncommon to have this amount released to the seller immediately as a non-refundable deposit. This means that if you are, as a buyer, do not proceed with the contract, they are compensated by keeping the deposit. Basically, how much is negotiated as an option fee and a deposit in advance, and how much is released to the seller immediately is totally a factor of what the market will bear and whether the purchase price is at market or above market value. If the purchase price is above market value, then usually the option fee and deposit in advance is lower. If the purchase price is at market, then the deposit and option fee is usually higher. Contract of sale. As described above, the second part of an option agreement is a contract of sale document. This will be the standard contract used in your state for selling a property, but in this instance, it will be pre-filled out with the buyer's and seller's details, the property details, the purchase price, deposit amount, and settlement timeframe, etc. The reason it is pre-filled out is because the terms of the sale have already been agreed to in negotiation of the option contract, and the sale contract is included to acknowledge that it is the instrument that will be used to actually settle on the property. Now, an important feature to be aware of is that the sale contract will have no finance clauses, no inspection clauses, and no special conditions. It will be a clean, unconditional contract. The order of events is that you sign the option agreement, and then when you exercise the option agreement, the sale contract document takes effect. All parties sign the sale contract, and then settlement occurs according to the settlement date specified, for example, 60 days. The sale contract is unconditional because you have already had the period of the option agreement to do your due diligence, finance, etc. Caveat and insurance. The last two items to be covered on option contracts is insurance and caveat. It is important to consider who is going to insure the property during the option contract because it can be for an extended period of time, particularly if you have negotiated a two-year option agreement. Preferably, make a condition of the option that the current owner must maintain insurance on the property and provide evidence to you that this has been done. This will save you money, and the owner should already have insurance in place, and so it should not be a major issue for them to keep it going. A caveat is a legal document that can be lodged on the title of a property to reflect the interest of another party in that property. It means that the property cannot be sold, or refinanced in most cases, without the interested party being notified, which in this instance is you, as the option and caveat holder. This is because it is written on the property title that a caveat is in place, and it cannot be sold without the caveat being removed. There's an example below. When you are negotiating an option agreement, negotiate to have a caveat put on the property to reflect and protect your legal interest in the property. The owner will need to consent to this and will need to agree to a consenting caveat or mutual caveat being lodged by the solicitor. If you think about the instance where the seller unexpectedly passes away with no caveat existing on the title, and let's say the seller never provided his solicitor with a copy of the signed option agreement, the property could be sold as part of the estate and no recognition given that in fact you have an option on the property. This is an extreme example, but certainly could be the case if you have a long option contract, have not corresponded with the buyer for an extended period of time, and perhaps you don't live in the local area to be able to go past the property regularly. Yes, this is an extreme example, but you get my point that having a caveat in place at the outset would have avoided this situation. Below is an example of how a caveat is shown on the title of a property when a title search is conducted. Joint venture agreement. Joint venture deals are a great strategy to leverage your time, your skills and experience, and your money, depending on your situation. If you have the time but not the money, then joining forces with another person with the money can be beneficial. And vice versa, if you have the money but not the time, then a joint venture may allow you to get into a deal that you otherwise couldn't. Or you may both contribute on a servicing and equity basis to a deal. The critical component when doing a JV is to ensure that you have a JV agreement or contract in place from the very beginning. A JV agreement needs to cover not only what happens when everything goes smoothly and you make a profit and need to split it at the end, but it also needs to cover all of the other what-if situations, like what if there isn't a profit but rather a loss? What if one of the parties dies or gets divorced? What if you don't agree on certain decisions? How will this be dealt with? These are all difficult questions, but ones that must be covered in your agreement. You also need to think about the general day-to-day processes of doing the deal, like who pays the bills, from what bank account, who decides if you need to register for GST, and who completes and lodges the BAS. How will you choose the paint colours and the selling agent, etc.? There are no right or wrong answers to any of these questions. The important thing is that you have thought about them, have agreed on a process, and have documented it formally upfront in a JV agreement. Please do not take the view that because your JV partner is your best friend or family member that everything will be fine. Yes, everything starts out great because everyone is excited and keen to make heaps of money, but this can turn quite quickly if you hit road bumps. If you don't have an agreement in place to guide you through the process, you definitely do not want any one deal to ruin your relationship. A joint venture agreement is again a legal document that needs to be drafted by a solicitor. To guide you in this process and the various questions and situations that need to be considered, discussed with your JV partner and covered in the agreement, the JV agreement checklist from Pacific Law has been included in the appendix. Due diligence. Now that we have been through some of the major contracts that you are likely to come across during your property journey, we need to discuss the many and varied due diligence items that you need to be aware of. Certainly, no one deal will have all of these issues, but it is not uncommon for half a dozen or more to impact on any one deal. This is particularly so when you are doing a development and having to comply with council requirements. This definitely opens up a whole raft of additional factors that you need to be aware of. Due diligence is doing your research to understand the impact that an item may have on your project. The item or situation may in fact be beneficial, but in most cases they are not, and hence why you need to first identify them, secondly understand their impact on your particular project, and thirdly what you can do to mitigate the impact. The aim here is to at least bring you an awareness of the main considerations, and while the broad spectrum has been covered, there will certainly be items that you come across that you should add to your own due diligence list to ensure you look out for in future deals. Remember that this whole property game is an ever-evolving process, and the more projects you do and the more diverse locations in which you do them, the more learning you will have along the way. You are encouraged to not just read through this list below, but make your own list and keep adding to it with every new learning that you have. For example, maybe you are doing a deal right on the beachfront and sea level rise could be an issue and something that you need to research. This then should be added to your due diligence checklist. Finally, it needs to be stressed that your due diligence research should be done as early in the process as possible, certainly before you go unconditional with the purchase. The reason for this is that if your research does unearth any potential issue, you want time to investigate it and still have the option to negotiate on it if necessary or get out of the contract if you just can't find a solution to the situation. It is advisable not to proceed with a deal that has issues that you have unearthed in your due diligence and much better than getting stuck with a dud. Clearly, if you are already unconditional or you own the property, you now have to be in solution mode because you don't have the option to pull out. Being caught with a problem property can not only cause you time delays and the potential loss of money and opportunity, but it can also be very stressful, and so avoiding these wherever possible is just plain good business. Working through the due diligence topics below, the specific property items will be looked at firstly, then the topics that could impact if you are considering developing a site, then the more general locational items, and finally the more administrative ones will be dealt with. It is hard to prioritise them because each individual item could be a potential showstopper, so please take heed of them all. Illegal building works. Illegal building works is anything at the property that is either not council approved, has not been built to comply with the Building Code of Australia, or has not been done by an appropriately licensed or qualified person. These are all situations that you want to pick up in the due diligence phase of purchasing a property before you go unconditional. This is because once you have bought the property, you now inherit and take on these problems, irrespective of the fact that you did not create them. The fact that you are now the owner means they are now your problem, so buyer beware. Let's deal with each of these in sequence. Illegal building works that are not council approved may include such things as existing decks, pergolas, sheds, garages, extensions, complete buildings like granny flats, plus attic conversions or garage conversions to habitable spaces like a bedroom, study or rumpus room. Let's deal with these last ones first. The issue with these conversions is that they often do not comply with legal ceiling height. For example, a Class 1 habitable area must be 2.4 metres in ceiling height for two-thirds of the room and no lower than 2.1 metres in height, whereas most garages are built at 2.1 metres ceiling height, and therefore a conversion of this space into a bedroom or living area would not be legally compliant, could not get council approval, and therefore it should not be used for this purpose and definitely should not be rented out to someone. The issue with unapproved decks is that they may not have been constructed to engineering specifications and could be a hazard waiting to happen. There have been several examples in the media where once a deck was loaded up with friends and family at a barbecue, it failed and caused significant injury and even death. Even an unapproved pergola or shed that may have been built too close to the boundary could cause devastating effects if it facilitated a fire spreading to and damaging the neighbour's property. With granny flats, apart from the fact that the building may not be council approved, the usage may not be either. For example, if you are looking to purchase a property with a granny flat and it is rented to a third party, you need to confirm that the council regulations in that area actually allow a non-related person to reside there. This is because there are many councils that still restrict a granny flat to being occupied by granny, or at least a person immediately related to the occupant of the main house. Amazingly, there are councils that require the granny flat building to be physically removed if a related person is no longer living there. Another situation that should ring alarm bells to you is a property that is being advertised as multiple occupancy and has, say, three or more income streams from rent, but is actually a residential house and located in a built-up residential street. Unless the seller can provide you with the appropriate approval of or compliance certificates, you would have to assume that these rentals are non-compliant, and again, something you need to be very wary of. It does not matter if these built structures have existed for the last 30, 40 or 50 years or have been used for this purpose for all that time in the past. The fact that they are not council approved means that they are illegal and the current property owner takes on the full responsibility. There are a number of ways to identify these non-compliant situations. Firstly, you should brief your building and pest inspector at your pre-purchase inspection to identify any structures that are not council approved and structures and works that are non-compliant with the current Building Code of Australia. You should also require that they highlight any renovation works completed on the property that should have had compliance certificates issued, for example, plumbing, electrical, gas and glazing works, to name a few. If the owner is not able to furnish you with these certificates, this should raise alarm bells with you immediately. You can also request and purchase from council a copy of the approvals they hold on record for the property. While the more recent records won't be a problem, don't be surprised if some councils do not hold older records for properties. This is because quite often a fire or flood destroyed these records sometime in the past. Many councils also offer a paid service where they will inspect a property for you to confirm if the structures that exist are council approved. Again, this will come at a cost and may take a bit of time, but is well worth the process if you suspect illegal building works on site. The next level of non-compliance is if works have been completed more recently but are not compliant with the current Building Code of Australia, or that have not been certified and completed by a licensed contractor, such as renovation works that are non-compliant. For example, electrical wiring, plumbing, gas and drainage works that do not look like they have been done to standard, or where a compliance certificate cannot be provided. It might be a bathroom renovation where evidence of approved waterproofing cannot be provided and a compliance certificate not issued. This alone can cause major problems with a building because over time moisture damage can result, dry rot can occur, and even termite activity prompted. Even unapproved glass shower screens and non-compliant fittings and fixtures that are not to Australian standards can be of major concern. Again, these are all things that you can request the building inspector to highlight to you, and they are also things that you can request as evidence from the seller. For example, if you are buying a newly built or newly renovated property, request from the seller copies of all approvals and certificates relating to the works. Please note, though, that many building inspectors are not qualified to report on electrical wiring, plumbing, gas, fittings, fireplaces and chimneys. And so if you are concerned with any of the aspects of the property in this regard, you need to engage specialist inspectors. If you have identified illegal building works, works not up to code, or unapproved usage, you are obviously in a strong position to be able to negotiate with the seller, assuming that you have done your due diligence during the conditional period of your purchase. You may be able to negotiate the purchase price down on the basis that you will have to rectify the works to ensure it is code compliant and council approved. Make sure, though, that you have had these works quoted and that you have added a margin for potential overrun and for your time and effort to coordinate. Remember, you make your money when you buy, so ensure that you buy well. It is also highly recommended that you liaise with council during this conditional phase to draw to their attention that you are looking to purchase the property and you are aware of illegal building works and that you want to work with them to rectify. In this instance, you want council to be supportive of you and your plan instead of taking a combative stance. Regardless of what council says, though, you want it to be in writing to ensure that the council attitude does not change from positive to negative partway through the process, and then you are left with a problem property on your hands. With regards to any unapproved structures on the property, these could also cause you issues when you want to get council approval to do additional approved works on the property. For example, if you intend to do an extension but already have an illegal granny flat on site, this could cause you issues, and you are likely to have to deal with the unapproved structure before you can get approval for the new structure. Even if you intend to demolish the building, you need to know in advance if you are taking on the liability of unapproved buildings on site. Now, if you are the one doing DIY works without the necessary license, this is a very dangerous position to be in, even if you have unsold the property and thought you got away with it. The reason this is still a major issue is because despite the fact that you are no longer the owner, the fact that you did the work like gas, plumbing, electrical or glazing, and someone else was injured, then you can still be held personally liable. Insurance will not cover you, and now all your assets are at risk, and in fact you could be jailed if significant personal injury resulted. 100% compliance is therefore the only way to go, including compliance with Council, the Building Code of Australia, and the licences required to undertake works. Please do not risk everything just because you are trying to save some money or time. It is definitely not worth it. Note that councils also have compliance officers that use aerial photographs to identify works being carried out that may not be council approved. They also drive around the streets, and even the presence of a skip bin out the front can be enough to alert them to potential works going on. In this situation, a council show cause notice may be issued, and then you will be required to defend your actions and works. Clearly, this compromises your position and is something that you want to avoid. This has been touched on above, but you need to be particularly aware that the insurances that you have on a property are likely to be completely null and void if the property consists of any illegal building works. That is, if there is anything at the property that is either not council approved, is not approved for the use it is being used for, has not been built to comply with the Building Code of Australia, or has not been done by an appropriately licensed or qualified person. It does not matter if you have been paying your insurance for the last 20 years. If the property is non-compliant in any way, then your insurance is likely to be compromised, and this is a very dangerous territory to be in. Property condition, termite damage, dry rot, concrete cancer, rising damp, asbestos, cracking walls and foundations. There are a whole raft of factors associated with the physical condition of a property that need to be factored into your due diligence. If you intend to keep the property, things that could be very impactful and expensive to rectify include termite damage, asbestos, dry rot, concrete cancer, rising damp, cracking walls and foundations, poorly maintained or old plumbing and electrical, and stumps and roofing in poor condition, to list a few. Even if you do not intend to keep the property, but rather demolish it, things like asbestos can still impact significantly on the cost, and therefore they need to be identified and factored into the costs up front. Most of these items should be able to be identified in a building and pest inspection report. However, it will come down to the diligence of the inspector. Where the property is furnished, the inspector may not be able to view the whole property and this can be an issue. Signs of recent repairs may also suggest a potential cover-up and maybe the owner's attempt to disguise the underlying issue. In this case, you need to be vigilant in looking out for anything that doesn't seem quite right. As with many of the other potential hazards that have been discussed, there are also opportunities associated with these hazards if you have educated yourself and are confident about providing a cost-effective solution. For example, asbestos and termite damage can turn many people off buying a property. However, if you have done your research and have experience in the management of these, you may know that in fact the cost to rectify may not be that prohibitive, and it is just other people's naivety that has scared them off the property. Do not get cocky or complacent in these areas though, as you don't want to get caught out yourself. Asbestos and termite damage were discussed in the renovation section of Module 5, but will be covered in a bit more detail again below from a due diligence perspective. Asbestos. The due diligence around asbestos is to educate yourself on what it looks like, where it is often found on a property, if it needs to be repaired or removed, how it can be repaired or removed, who should do the works, and the likely costs. Material containing asbestos is widespread in older dwellings because it was used so prevalently in the construction industry, and in fact, it was only fully banned for use in building materials in 2003. It can be found in the wall and ceiling sheetings, bathroom floorings, exterior cladding, sheeting and soffit, roof sheeting, see below, tiles, vinyl, glues, pipes, cement, and even in fence material. Asbestos needs to be managed professionally because of its adverse health impacts. Understanding the regulations for handling and working around this material is imperative, and you need to educate yourself before you start working around it. If left in place and undisturbed, it can be inert and non-friable, meaning the asbestos fibres remain encapsulated in the matrix they are bound with, and hence not harmful. However, as soon as the asbestos-containing material is damaged, drilled into, broken, or even cleaned with a high-pressure hose, this can cause asbestos particles to dislodge, become friable, airborne, and as hazardous to those working near and around it. For this reason, all work with asbestos should be undertaken by a licensed asbestos removal company. These same companies can inspect a property to identify the asbestos materials that it may contain. They can also take samples to have tested for asbestos to confirm its presence or not in any of the less obvious materials.